And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, radio for your community. And certainly we've had a very busy show today. Lots is happening, lots going on. But we're very excited now because with us we should have Afshin Ratansi. And he's in New York right now. And he's someone who's very active, very involved in things because he has helped launch and develop television networks and has worked in journalism for more than two decades at the BBC Today program, CNN International, Bloomberg News, Al Jazeera Arabic, and the Dubai Business Channel, as well as Press TV and The Guardian. So he certainly has a lot of experience, and he now has a quartet of novels entitled The Dream of the Decade, available on Amazon.com. And from what I've seen in his Counterpunch articles, I'd be encouraged to look at that. So Afshin, thank you very much for being on the program with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Ben.
Well, I know you've had some articles that have come my way on Counterpunch, just checking it out every day or every week. And certainly on the 1st of June, you had that wonderful article about women in Darfur, women in Sudan. And you had spoken with two women from the United Kingdom who had attended a women's issues conference there. My notes say I think it was Colette Valentine, a TV producer, and Ali Gunn, a media consultant. Yes, so they had met with women in Darfur, according to the article that you had written. So they basically had free rein to speak with anyone, right? They could go anywhere.
That's right. I mean, I think one thing to emphasize about the situation in Darfur is that there are many competing interests over coverage of that area. And I think both these women who went to visit were very conscious that they could be conscious of any minding or any people from the Khartoum government showing them certain parts of Darfur and not others. They were allowed to roam freely, according to what they said, and they were on the watch for anyone trying to persuade them of one view against another.
That's right. So they went where they wanted to go. They looked at the refugee camps, and as far as I can gather, it seemed like it was a pretty simple existence in those camps. But how would what they saw compare to the way that the media tends to describe these camps?
Well, I think they were shocked. I was shocked on hearing from them. I mean, if one looks at the Save Darfur Coalition website right now on the internet, you'll see that they have a piece talking about ongoing genocide in Darfur. Certainly these two women saw no evidence of that. I think it builds on some of the work that the Columbia professor Mahmoud Mamdani has written about, in that the figures for what they call genocide seem very controversial indeed. I think there are advertisements on the New York subway system saying 400,000 have been killed through violence in Darfur. That those figures don't match the General Accounting Office of the United States figures.
Well, if I recall correctly, the Save Darfur campaign equivalent in the United Kingdom was taken to court for the figures that it was bandying about the number that was killed, and it had to retract its statements.
That's right. Well, of course, any person's death is something to be saddened by, but we can go on to the implications of why statistics should be used in this way. The U.S. General Accounting Office said that the figure the Save Darfur Coalition are using is the least reliable, and that the figure they said that they most favored, it's obviously very difficult in a situation like Darfur to calculate accurately. They went with the World Health Organization affiliated Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters, came up with a figure of 131,000, then you looked at it in more detail, and it said that 30% of those were due to violence. And one should say that in 2008, the figure was 1,500 dead, which over the whole year, which doesn't even count as in criteria for judging a UN emergency, let alone ongoing genocide, which is what is maintained not only by the Save Darfur Coalition, but such strange bedfellows as George Clooney and John Bolton.
Well, it's interesting. There's basically a parade of celebrities, and certainly on this program, we like to make reference to how ridiculous it can get sometimes. There was the case where Mia Farrow had advocated sending Blackwater, the mercenary organization, to Darfur, and others have suggested sending attack helicopters and so forth. At the beginning of your article, you had mentioned that there's actually quite a lot with George Clooney, Mick Jagger, Mia Farrow. I can't remember all the names, really.
Yes, Scarlett Johansson. I can only presume that all these stars have signed up to it in good faith without, though, looking into the facts further. It raises quite a few questions about this Save Darfur coalition. I know that some people have done work, again, Professor Mamdani doing work on them, phoned up the Save Darfur coalition. And we must remember this is in the context of a war in Iraq that well over a million may have died, largest displacement in human history after the during the Iraq invasion. In the context of all of this, the big money was on the Save Darfur campaign. Not one penny of the money from the Save Darfur campaign, it seems, goes to the people of Darfur. They readily admit this, saying that they're an advocacy group and they're not a charity. They're not an aid organization.
I think there had been some problems within that organization over accountability. Some people had to step down, I think. But certainly you've made a very good point, and that is, in your article, you talked about certain U.S. senators or members of the government who were arrested for, they staged a symbolic protest against Sudan. Where were these people during Iraq? Were they throwing themselves in front of their own U.S. embassies or their own buildings?
I think some of them were concerned about that, which means that this is not this is to do with ignorance at one level. Anything more sinister we can talk about, but it is the biggest mass movement in the United States, certainly since anti-Vietnam. I know in Canada, Save Darfur coalition groups have sprung up. So it's interesting how it got this big and managed to make senators, get themselves arrested on behalf of this. One person who was the head of the campaign was the president of the public relations firm M&R Strategic Services, which was hired by the Save Darfur campaign. And I think Spinwatch, I'm not sure if people from them have appeared on your program, but this firm has been accused of greenwashing when it comes to DuPont, the famous chemical manufacturer. So all that's very murky indeed as well.
That's fascinating, actually. Maybe the anti-war movement in the United States should have hired some of these PR organizations. Obviously, there is, a Hollywood aspect to this. There's media, there's public relations organizations, famous big names, all getting in with a campaign that has some very slick materials.
That's right. And behind all of this, one has to ask why. Why did this happen? And one has to look, I think, at the fact that Sudan is very, very rich in oil resources. And in a sense, the tale of what happened in Darfur is being repeated all around the developing world. A belief that aid organizations can go into countries and affect goings-on rather than grassroots organizations of people in those areas. I think one can see elements of this in Afghanistan with massive NGO involvement in Pakistan, both at the front line of President Obama's, war on terror. Certainly, these women that went to Darfur, what they saw of UN aid was not too good.
Right. That reminds me of what I read in your article. It spoke about how those women, when there are conversations with Sudanese women and other people, that They learn more and more that people felt the conflict was about oil, that it was about the water resources that are diminishing in certain areas and increasingly important in parts of Africa. And they were pretty leery about the international presence. They felt that Sudan, just the ordinary person on the street, felt that Sudan as a country was being picked on.
That's right. And UN peacekeepers were the only people really seeming to turn guns on people in the area that they visited, and the people in the villages, in the refugee camps, were saying if the money that goes on all these guns, on the tanks, all the four-wheel drive cars, if that could be given, that would be great to the people on the ground. But no sign of that. And as you say, you mentioned the environmental degradation. One should say that the Sahara's southern region has expanded by 100 kilometers. Desertification is one of the roots of the conflict there, as well as the legacy of colonial divide and rule by the British government there, and the legacy of masses and masses of guns and weapons to fuel wars. We saw this because yet another in the so-called Cold War, very hot for developing nations. In the Chad Civil War, Israel, U.S., France on one side, Libya and the United and the USSR on the other, flooding the area with weapons. But all of this gets washed away with organizations, NGOs, seeking to depoliticize events and just saying, you know, you're a human being, these are really sad people, look at these black people dying, give money. And then that money goes on adverts.
One of the reasons they say that it's so important to have international, you know, especially U.S., Canadian, and so forth, aid in Sudan is that you can't trust the government in Sudan. You know, they're corrupt and so on. I mean, those women visited the presidential palace in Sudan, right? So was it all this ostentatious gold-plated palace or what?
Well, I can very much understand the concerns about aid money just being given to leaders in Africa where elections have been controversial, although one should say that President al-Bashir was elected, according to outside observers, and all sides now agree that his indictment in the International Criminal Court more or less guarantees him an electoral success in upcoming elections next year. The two women that visited and met with the president said it was a relatively austere presidential palace. He didn't have much of a guard with him. He walked around relatively freely, and you know, there was no Louis XIV furniture and glistening gold and diamond interior design to a massive palace. One has to be wary, of course, about all these things. And I think the women in the refugee camps that they met said that the money shouldn't necessarily be given to you know, central government, but to organizations or women's groups from the ground up. There's a huge scale. The women's union there they have thousands of different branches, and it really is involved in education and healthcare, and it moves from the ground up right to professional women who are from more middle-class backgrounds, right down to the peasantry.
Right, I see. When these women were having discussions, I understand that one of the things that came up is that it seemed that the Sudanese felt that the Clinton administration staff, the Clinton-era people, were among those who were most hostile to Sudan, and now they're a bit concerned that a lot of those people are back in the halls of power.
That's right. I mean, one should put a bit of hope in this, because there do seem to be some signs that Bill Clinton's wife, of course, Secretary of State, may be altering policy now, or there are elements in the State Department that may be altering policy in the new Obama administration. But certainly, President Bill Clinton was, of course, a disaster for Sudan. One must remember that while all this aid money, some of it does go there from some of the aid agencies, but sanctions were implemented. And Bill Clinton famously attacked with Cruise Missiles, a pharmaceutical laboratory, under the pretext that Osama bin Laden was living there. So there's bound to be some kind of suspicion about the Clinton people that are now occupying positions in the Obama administration.
Right. So we have cruise missiles from the Clinton administration, we have sanctions, we have colonial legacy, we have the U.S. And other countries sending arms throughout Africa, we have desertification, multiple civil wars going on in Sudan, and this is all glossed over because we hear about these depoliticized humanitarian crisis in which we need to send in the blue helmets. Now, the woman on the ground there, they of course didn't see things that way. So they didn't see a genocide, and they didn't see those allegations about rape being used as a weapon as credible in their eyes either.
Yeah, they asked about that and said that there were instances of rape, but in no way matching the kind of narrative put forward by the Save Darfur coalition. At least that's what they experienced when they talked to women from all communities that were living in the refugee camps there. So again, the use of, in the Western imagination, of using this, look at these people, they're using rape as a weapon and so forth, at the moment, as the situation is now in Darfur, they didn't see that. And you're going through all those different complicated issues surrounding this conflict. I noticed in a Canadian paper, the Vancouver Sun, the applause for the creator or the producers of Sesame Street, the children's program, talking about how Sesame Street will be able to make issues much more simple. And Darfur is the one that they want to educate children with. I think one frightening element of this is the way this is entering high schools, universities, all at a time when, of course, the real wars are occurring, or the real killing at the moment, arguably, is in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Right. I mean, first of all, you've got a civil war being portrayed as a humanitarian crisis, and then a lot of people who say they're concerned about that not talking about Iraq. But I'm really concerned about the Sesame Street aspect of this, because certainly I found that the Darfur issue it's come up and it's been presented in the manner that you're describing on Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip back when that show was running. It's been presented on the West Wing. It pops up now and then, especially, you know, in those liberal democratic type programs that youth and trendy people are watching. And they're just getting this one-sided narrative on this issue. So what do you think is one of the directions or a main direction of this thrust?
That's right. Well, in Iraq, I think Canadians, Americans, certainly in Britain, it was a terrible feeling for so many people, let alone the reasons for war. And I worked on the program which had David Kelly, the government scientist who committed suicide in the initial stages of the reasons for Iraq war, the persuasion period. And now, I think most people would say it's very complicated, the situation in Iraq, what must be done for the future, how one can unite the different elements in that country. There's nothing simple about that. It's very, very political. It's about politics. It's about the oil law. Darfur, on the other hand, there are these pictures of starving kids, and it seems, on the surface, a way for people to go, hey, I can, and people are generous. I mean, there's a reason it's $1 billion a year aid program for Darfur and nothing like that for Somalia or what's been happening in Congo. Basically, this is presented as you're at home, you give money, and you can actually save people. There's nothing political about this. Again, Professor Mahmoud Mamdani, this Columbia professor, talks about how the Iraq conflict, one has to engage with it as a citizen. One has to think about the politics of the area. Darfur depoliticizes it and just puts it on a human level. And it seems to me that the depoliticization of events, so beloved by NGOs, and some of them who I've met members of, who I have great respect for, and I think I've changed a little. I mean, Sudan has kicked out Médecins Sans Frontières, Oxfam, Save the Children. These are heroic names. But all these sorts of groups, they depoliticize events. They don't think about the future in the way that societies have historically developed.
Well, that's a very apt comparison you've made, and I'm glad you mentioned Mamdani's book. I just received it a few days ago. It's called Saviors and Survivors, I believe his latest book on Sudan and Darfur, and he makes a number of the points that you are in, and certainly the fact that a movement for intervention has coalesced on the subject of Sudan at the same time as there has been a lack of appropriate action to move out of Iraq. So I think that's very worth paying attention to.
That's right. I mean, I think one could make a case for it should have been the other way around. Different countries should have perhaps intervened in Washington.
Yes, well, again, there hasn't been those big movements to have international community intervention to stop U.S. wars. You know, it doesn't work that way. Before we go, I'm just wondering, you had also mentioned China. With the UK woman who had visited there, what were they picking up in terms of feelings about the Chinese?
I mean, one empire dies, as so many people are saying. The United States empire, one rises. I think many people believe that China will be that next empire. One has to be very wary of any empire, I think. But so far, it has to be said that the Chinese, the impression they got were the Chinese go into countries, take the resources, and put the money there, and don't seem to really be interested in hegemonic power as the British, the French, the United States, all those colonial governments are. It's far too early to make long-term predictions about this. Policy in the Chinese Communist Party may change. But certainly the way they were seeing it, and from the people that they spoke to on the ground, they seem much happier about the way that the Chinese were involved. Certainly, they did hear that story, which sounds so apocryphal, that when Chevron went for drilling rights in Sudan and they were kicked out, they took all the maps away. They didn't even want them to exploit it. The way the Chinese are going in there, they're investing a lot in oil exploration and so forth. And unlike, say, in Iraq, where the United States, under that previous oil law, which hasn't passed, they wanted to go in, get the oil, but also have people from the United States-based multinationals and so forth on the boards of companies in Baghdad running things, as well as the oil being sold at preferential rates to the United States.
Well, this is very interesting. It's too bad we have to go. I'm just wondering, do you plan on writing anything more on this subject? Because I think it would be very interesting and valuable to read.
I think it's interesting. You mentioned China, the growth of a country like Sudan. In that article, those two women say that the signs of development, thanks to the fact that the U.S. is sanctioned, they've left it alone. It looks like Khartoum may be booming, not with the sound of gunfire, but with economic development. It just can be left alone by so many NGOs, humanitarian organizations. If they can just get out of the country and get out of so many African countries and allow these countries to develop, maybe there's a sign of hope for the future.
Well, that's definitely a way of looking at it. Again, Afshin, thanks very much. We'll have to go, and I'll let our listeners know about where to find you. And again, I'd just like to thank you for your incisive analysis today.
Thank you for having me, Brenda.
Okay. Well, thanks. Bye-bye. And that was Afshin Ratansi. Again, he's heavily involved in media of all sorts, having helped launch and develop television networks, working in journalism for 20 years, and at the BBC Today program, as well as a number of others, like we mentioned, CNN, Bloomberg, Al Jazeera, and so forth. And definitely, you can pick up his quartet of novels, The Dream of the Decade, on Amazon.com. What I'd recommend you do most, however, is go to Counterpunch, www.counterpunch.org, and go look up his article from June 1st. You'll have to, go into the bottom of the page, into the archives or whatever. But it's June 1st, and he wrote his article about women in Darfur. And, I mean, alternately, you could just Google "women in Darfur" together with Counterpunch, or just our guest's name, Afshin Ratansi. That's R-A-T-T-A-N-S-I, Ratansi, R-A-T-T-A-N-S-I, and Darfur and Woman. Google that. You'll get his article on Counterpunch. Very interesting. Doing the kind of research that really should be done on this issue.